Well, Peter Hitchens, great to have you on the show. He joins us now. What do you say to people, Peter, who said, actually, we've got a great deal to lose if we fail to take these conformist measures? Because the modelling, and I know you question some of the modelling, but the modelling shows that you could potentially have 500,000 deaths. So surely it's worth the risk.
The modelling is speculation and, frankly, guesswork. And it comes, I believe, from the same source as came up with the extraordinary suggestion which led, you may remember, the great foot and mouth epidemic on our farms 19 years ago, which I was much involved in covering. And I remember walking around the country lanes of Devon watching farmers weeping as they had to massacre and put onto huge pyres huge numbers of healthy cattle. And it wasn't, I don't believe, a success, and I think many of the people who were involved in it now look back on it as having been, at the very least, an overreaction. I think one has to understand that there are differences among experts on this matter. I've posted on Twitter, a very interesting and actually quite fascinating interview with a professor in Germany who's very skilled in these matters, who says these measures are likely to be disastrous, particularly, he says, for the old, who are going to be deprived of all the things which make life worth living. And then, of course, there's the economic aspect of this. After the crashing of our economy, which is what the government has definitely achieved, and the attack on civil liberties, which I believe it's engaged in cramming through Parliament at the moment, these things are actually happening. And after the crashing of the economy, how are we going to be able to afford the level of health services and medical services that we have now? And will we be as healthy a country as we are now, once we're so much poorer, as we are going to be thanks to this deliberate policy? You'll have to explain to me how crashing the economy and restricting civil liberties is going to prevent the spread of the disease, because I can't see any logical connection between the two actions. You talk about the distances we're supposed to keep from each other and all the rest. I'm perfectly happy to abide by these rules if people think they're useful. I've talked to experts about these, and there's no doubt that the virus can spread quite easily, and one should try as far as one can to prevent it. Since this all began, I've been very careful about frequent hand washing, and I've always believed in that sort of thing anyway, and I've redoubled it, and I respect people's fear of catching it, so I keep my distance. So that's all makes perfect sense, and I don't see any reason why not. But closing down the entire economy is not necessary, and you could easily rely on the civility and good sense of people to keep the necessary distance while continuing to run a functioning economy. And the other simple point is this: are we taking proportionate action? This virus is presented as if it was some immense scourge, killing untold and unheard of numbers of people. It simply is not the case by comparison with previous things. Many people have been dying in recent years, and indeed the health service has struggled hugely to cope with the problem of influenza. So, for instance, I got these figures from the government last week because I felt it should be spared. They said that the number of flu cases and deaths due to flu-related complications in England alone, this doesn't include Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland, averages 17,000 a year. And this varies greatly each winter, ranging from 1,692 deaths last season, that's 2018-19, to 28,330 deaths from influenza complications in 2014-15. And people need to understand, it's very sad, and no one is more anxious than I to prevent unnecessary and preventable deaths, but each day in this country, 1,600 people do die. And so the figures which are being put forward by some of my media colleagues as if they were some sort of hecatomb of death are not actually as shocking as they're portrayed to be. And people use these terms like jumped and doubled and enormous. And I don't think this is actually true. People are exaggerating the severity of it. And then there is another very simple point here. I make it first of all, we all talk a lot about prostate cancer, especially men. An awful lot of men die with prostate cancer, but they don't die of it.
Yes.
It's not the cause of death. Yes. And what's happening is that people are dying. And again, I checked this with the government. There haven't been autopsies and inquests into the people who are classified as having died with COVID-19. All that's happened is they've tested positive for COVID-19 and they've died. But in many cases, the real cause of their death is the fact that they've reached a great age and have underlying problems. And the interesting thing will be to see if we calmly examine this, has the actual death rate risen, or have we simply reclassified certain deaths
but
in
the
one
problem
form
is
or
the,
another?
But the problem
it's
is we
an
don't
urge
know.
There's a calmness in the face of figures that's not being shown by the government or by much of the media.
Well, no, I totally understand what you're saying there. The problem is, I guess, we don't know for sure because you praised Boris Johnson's early handling of this crisis, and I did too, because it seemed very measured. But then you obviously had social media hysteria come in. You had a lot of pressure given what was happening in other countries as well. And one of the real issues here, and it is a huge issue, is that you've got the risk of not acting now, which history could potentially show to be a massive folly. And I'm wondering what you think of the Times editorial today. Remember, this is a newspaper that has been traditionally very favourable to Boris Johnson, saying that he's risking being this generation's Neville Chamberlain by his lack of action.
Well, I thought that was plain silly. There is no comparison. This is not a war that we're dealing with. This is a disease. And the diseases aren't fought by armament or by strategy on the battlefield and macho gestures. To the extent that they can be fought, they're fought by the great skill and dedication of medical staff, whom I unhesitatingly praise, and who are obviously taking considerable risk at the moment, as they do all the time, and especially in winter, in a health service which every winter comes close to being overwhelmed by cases affecting predominantly those who are elderly and those who are already ill, who contract problems particularly with their breathing. And this is the difficulty which comes. There are lots of ways of fighting disease. The question here is the method which we're adopting proportionate or sensible, and is it proven to work? Now, everyone goes on about Italy, and what's going on in Italy is distressing, and Italy is a country that those of us who know it love greatly, and we see it, we think, well, this is awful. But it is not the only country which is suffering from COVID-19. If you look at Japan, or indeed if you look at South Korea, or Germany, or Iceland, or many other places, you'll find a completely different outcome. And it's not, there's no obvious connection between draconian measures of shutting down the country and a decline in the disease. And viruses are very strange things. They come and they go. And one of the things I have to say which weakens them greatly is warmer weather and ultraviolet light. And so we might hope that with the improvement in the weather, that might indeed give some pause to the disease. But that's simply an optimistic remark from me. And since I'm generally pessimistic, you should take note of it. But I think those who want to advocate these extraordinarily dangerous measures which the government are now taking have to come up with some reason to say this is going to work. Oddly enough, this is what they're doing in Italy and in France, and there isn't all that much sign that, and Spain, and there isn't all that much sign that it's making any difference. My strong suspicion is that the virus was loose in this country probably as long ago as December. But many people have, in fact, had it, because most people will have it either with very mild symptoms or with no symptoms at all. And I know lots of people who will say that they had it or something which sounds very like it back in December or January, but nobody knows. They've not been tested. They're not on the record. So the idea that's being spread that there's a terribly high mortality rate simply doesn't work. I quoted Professor Ioannidis from Stanford University in California, who makes this point that so many of the figures for mortality being tossed about are based on completely inadequate estimates of how many people are actually getting the disease. I listed also from Simon Jenkins's excellent article. So the number of previous panics of this kind,
which have come
to nothing, and
swine flu, SARS,
someone will say, oh, I don't care about old people dying or some such rubbish. Of course, I care about old people dying. I'm old myself, for goodness sake. But leaving that aside, it's absurd to accuse me of being any more callous than anybody else. The point is, if we do crash the economy, and I think we are crashing it at the moment, we will have less money to spend on the National Health Service forever. And how much damage is that going to do to people? And we will have less money to spend on all kinds of public health measures. And we will have a lower standard of living. And we will have more pollution and dirtier air and all the other things which poor countries have, which will make people's lives shorter and more disease-prone.
It's an absolutely fascinating debate. Peter Hitchens, columnist at the Mail on Sunday. Thank you for making it. What do you think?